Hello and welcome to the Farming Advice Service podcast. Farming Advice Service, or FAS, as you'll hear it referred to in this podcast, is funded by DEFRA to help farmers in England understand and meet the requirements of cross compliance, the basic payment scheme, and other UK policies. This podcast complements our other information sources, and you can find more on events, webinars, technical articles, and other online resources at farmingadviceservice.org.uk. And you can also follow us on Twitter at DEFRA FAS, which is at DEFRA FAS. My name is Laura Harpham, and for this episode, I'll be joined by Ian Cairns, who's talking to us about approaches you can take to help reducing the risk of cross-compliance breaches relating to livestock. It's great to have Ian joining us for this podcast. We'll be covering a few areas briefly, but if you'd like a more in-depth review of this topic, you can also watch the recording of the webinar Ian led for us last month, which has a section on the Livestock Information Service with guest Ad West. So please do go online to farmingadviceservice.org.uk in the webinar section to watch that in full. So before we get into talking about the common cross-compliance breaches relating to livestock, I'll ask Ian to introduce himself. Ian, welcome and thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your background, please?
Thanks, Laura, and thanks for having me along today. My name's Ian Cairns. I am a livestock consultant based in the north of England, in Northumberland. And I've been involved in FAS delivery since, I think, 2007. So it probably makes me a veteran of some sort in fast delivery.
Absolutely.
I also have a farm at home where we run sheep and suckler cows and rear calves. So I have a bit of a working knowledge of cross compliance as well.
Fantastic. Sounds like we're in very good hands. Thank you. It's great to have you on. So obviously we are at the point of recording, about 3 months into 2022. So if we can start out with a quick update on what cross compliance for livestock looks like this year. Are there any rule changes that people need to know about? And if we get an insight from previous years, what we're expecting to be the key risk areas or things to focus on?
Yeah, there are no real changes to the technical side of the cross compliance rules in 2022. We know we're going to have cross compliance as we know it until 2024. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the payments will be delinked from land parcels and the cross compliance or whatever follows will change at that point. What RPA are keen to see and for farmers to notice is a change of emphasis to the cross compliance visits. So really it's all about appropriate level of checking and appropriate level of penalty if that was to apply, and that farmers at the end of the process feel they have more information about the technical areas of the cross compliance checks than they did before. I think there was a feeling from a farmer's point of view that under the previous inspection regimes that really it was very much an inspector coming onto the farm and very much looking for problems, if you like, on the farm. So that's a bit of a change.
Brilliant, thank you. It ties in with some of the updates that we heard in another podcast and webinar that we ran earlier in the year in terms of a shift away from kind of top-down penalties and more towards guidance and support to achieve the aims that cross compliance is there to achieve in terms of environmental protection and making sure that everybody's doing what they need to meet that, which certainly from my experience of working in the industry, most people want to. There is a willingness to do the right thing. It's just sometimes a little bit difficult to know exactly how to do that. And hopefully the wider FAS guidance and podcasts like this can help give people a bit of a clue as to where to get started at least.
Absolutely, yeah.
So to come back to the, you mentioned cross-compliance visits. Previously, people would have referred to them as inspections, but we know that the terminology and the attitude to those is changing a bit. But we do have records from the last few years. The RPA release them every year in terms of what breaches we see in cross-compliance. And we know that typically livestock is a really challenging area, and particularly movements and ID. So if you imagine for a moment that I've just had a notification of a compliance visit, can you give us an idea of what I need to be thinking about? What should I have in hand and how can I make it as straightforward for myself as possible?
Yeah, The RPA do give sort of short notice, really, of a cross-compliance visit, but really there's not going to be enough time to react to that in terms of your farm systems. Mm-hmm. So I suppose the important thing is to, you know, understand how the rules apply to you and maintain systems that are appropriate for the numbers of animals that you have on your farm. The big areas, you know, that we see farmers having problems with during standalone cattle and sheep inspections, and to a lesser extent, animal welfare inspections under the SMRs in cross compliance. A lot of the problem areas are to do with on-farm record keeping,
right,
and the details on the farm about the livestock not matching up with the national databases, and if it's appropriate, certainly in the case of cattle, that maybe not matching up with the passport details.
So
there are some issues there with sort of certainly maintaining appropriate on-farm records of movements, of births and deaths of livestock. And if you have sheep, for example, have a look at the guidance on record keeping systems for sheep, because there are some specific areas of record keeping for sheep which maybe surprise some sheep farmers in terms of things like a record of deaths, and where appropriate, recording the ID of the animals that have died, mm-hmm, in those records, and also recording the date of tagging. So that would apply to all sheep, even if you're tagging them as a batch as they go off the farm to slaughter, for example, mm-hmm, that you would record that sort of application of the tags into the sheep as a separate record. And the third one is replacement tagging. So if you find that sheep have lost their ID, you record the re-tagging event. So the date that it happens, any of the original IDs that still remain in the sheep, and the new ID that's been fitted. So that's specific to the sheep inspection.
Okay.
But most of the issues, you know, that we see are to do with things like, you know, records not matching up with that national database. So the person coming on farm and carrying out that cross-compliance visit would have a printout of recent movements on and off the farm in each of the livestock categories, and would be looking to see those records matching up with the on-farm record. So, you know, that's a major area. So the largest single area of non-compliance for cattle ID and movements are that movements that have taken place aren't recorded in the farm records.
Okay.
So that's a key area, really. I think a third of all breaches are to do with movements not being reported or recorded. So that means writing down the event, the movement event, in your own farm records, but also notifying the national database. So for cattle, that would be the CTS, cattle tracing system, and for sheep, it would be ARAMS.
Okay, great. And as you say, not necessarily something that you can correct at the last minute if you're notified of a visit. So something to keep on top of day to day, both from a good business practice perspective, but also that when you have a visit, you've got everything to hand that the visitor is going to require.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, having, you know, reasonable backup information, because, you know, if you think about the sheep movement system to ARAMS, if you're really a farmer who's producing sheep and selling them off either for slaughter or selling them through a livestock market, it'll be somebody else, the receiving keeper, who will be reporting that movement to the ARAMS database. Mm-hmm. So if there's a difference found between the on-farm records and the ARAMS database for sheep, then to have, you know, a copy of the movement form, which sort of shows what was agreed in terms of the number of animals and the ID of those animals as they left the farm, that can help to provide more evidence that the on-farm records are correct.
Yep.
And also, you know, for cattle, for example, where individual animal movements would be reported and recorded, to have a list from an auction mart or from the trader who moved the animals, or from the abattoir, to have a list of those IDs which show the date of the movement taking place, can help back up the on-farm records and show that they're correct.
As you say, if there are any instances of discrepancies, as long as you have all of the records pertain to your activity, your actions, then you've got that backup. Thanks, really helpful. In terms of animal inspection, so livestock that's still on the farm, can people expect for the cross-compliance visitor to go out and be looking at individual animals?
Yeah, part of the inspection involves checking livestock on the farm. So for cattle, it would be a check of all animals, all cattle beasts on the farm. And this might be that, obviously, that can be quite complex on some farms. So at the start of the visit, the RPA staff will sort of agree a timetable for the whole visit to take place. So it might not all happen on that one day. It right. may well be over a number of smaller visits to make it reasonable for all the animals to be checked. In the case of sheep, normally the live animal check is to sort of get a total head count of the sheep that are on the farm on the day of the visit, and to make sure that ties in with the on-farm records. So that could be working back to the date when the annual inventory number was declared for sheep on the farm. So that would be for the 1st of December each year. Mm-hmm. The second part of that is really a tagging compliance check to make sure that the sheep are identified as they should be for the appropriate age group. And that would normally be, no matter how many sheep are on the farm, a physical check, of 60 animals. And if a problem's found in those 60 to do with the tagging system that's employed on the farm, it may well be that further animals have to be gathered to show it's not a widespread problem. But normally it's just 60 sheep.
Okay, thanks. Really useful and good to have those specifics as well. In the webinar that we ran with you a little while ago, there was also a couple of specific questions from attendees, and one was around tag secure storage and also the requirements of tags being readable both with a tag reader and visually. Can you give us any indication as to what the requirements are there?
Yeah, as part of the cross-compliance visit, there would be a check on the supply of unused tags on the farm. So for sheep, for example, there would be an expectation that you would have an appropriate supply of replacement tags according to the whether you've bought in or you rear your own replacements on the farm. Mm-hmm. And also, those tags, although they have to have a visual ID, so for a batch tag, it would just be the flock number for that farm. But there would be an EID chip built into the tag as well. And when the check of the tags takes place, the tags must be readable with an EID reader. So that's for sheep. The mm-hmm. yellow tags must have a functioning chip. But of course, if you haven't got your own reader and there's no obligation to do that, mm-hmm. it may well be that that problem would only be found at the inspection.
Okay.
So as long as you put that right afterwards, that would be no problem. With regards to the safe storage and secure storage, that's really that you've got the tags under your own control. The danger would be that somebody else has access to them and could fraudulently use them to identify their own animals with your ID. So, it's what really is practical. And I'm sure we would all talk about, they should be locked and safe. But it's just things like they're not lying about in your pickup or around the farm that somebody else could get access to them and use them fraudulently.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you. And it sounds like the best approach, as with the records, is just to incorporate a check. So a visual check when you're doing your livestock checks both on sheep and cattle just to make sure that all the tags are where they are supposed to be, that they're in good enough of a nick that if you needed to check the numbers or scan, then you can reasonably expect you could get the information that you need.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's useful, certainly, if you build in a couple of times in the year when you're handling your livestock, mm-hmm. just to do an ID check and make sure that breeding ewes, for example, and all your cattle are fitted with the full set of ID that they should be. Mm-hmm. And if you're finding any sort of ID missing, then you have 28 days to order and replace those tags from the date of noticing the loss. And make sure those tags that are ordered, especially for cattle, are fitted within the 28 days, because that's the requirement. You know, it would be a sort of follow, the system could be followed up at inspection to show when tags were ordered mm-hmm. and that they had been fitted to the animals.
Okay, so 28 days between ordering, fitting. Don't just have them delivered to the office and then leave them waiting around for weeks. Good stuff. Yeah. Great. Okay, so we've talked about ID and day-to-day checks as well as records. Slightly different type of question there, but I know that we talked about it in the webinar and it sounds like it might be a potential way for people to make things easier for themselves. And that's CPH rationalization and temporary land associations. And I believe there are some rules around cattle movements within a 10-mile radius. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah, it would apply to both sheep and to goats and cattle as well. But really, the default situation would be if you have more than one CPH number that you keep your cattle or sheep on, generally the default would be if you move those animals from one CPH number to another, then that would be a reported and recorded movement. Right. Under the rules that apply to sheep and cattle. So that replaces the system that we used to have of links that BCMS would have created between different CPH numbers, and we didn't have to report and record movements. Mm-hmm. So the only options now for people who have more complex businesses with more than one CPH number is to consider if it would be practical for you to rationalize the land that you have within a 10-mile radius of your main CPH number, if you have other land parcels that you use and they're permanently available to you, could you add those land parcels onto your main CPH number? Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're just expanding out to as far as 10 miles your farm holding. And the benefit of rationalizing the field IDs into one CPH is that if they are all in one CPH number, then you wouldn't have to report or record any movements because it would be seen to be within your farm business. The other possibility is, the other option that you have is to register with the Animal Plant Health Agency to set up associations with other field parcels for a one-year period of time. Through this process called temporary land associations. And it's basically a couple of pages of admin form that you submit to Animal Plant Health Agency, and they would create an association between land parcels mm-hmm. and your main CPH number, providing it's within 10 miles of your main holding, but only for up to 1 year. So you can, redo that arrangement for another year, but you would need to do it again. Whereas the rationalization of your CPH would be permanent merger of all your land parcels into one CPH number. So it depends a little bit on how long you would have access to the different field parcels as to what route you would take. But it does mean considerable simplification if you can either rationalize your CPH or set up temporary land associations, because there would be fewer entries in your record system and there would be fewer reported movements to the national database because it's all correctly associated together within your farm business.
Got it. Okay, thank you. And for either of those options, do you have to be either the owner or the legal tenant of the land, or can you use them for things like you're taking your animals to graze on somebody else's property, for example?
Yeah, it's much more straightforward if you've got some sort of written agreement with the person they're using the land from. But really, it's this process would be overseen by the keeper of the livestock. So if you want to graze your sheep on a field parcel that's remote to your CPH number, you'd have to have the consent of that landowner, and you would be responsible as the keeper for setting up that temporary land association. So there are some benefits from doing that, but beware that there are some issues that it raises as well. So, for example, if you bring some sheep onto a remote field parcel, but it's associated with your main CPH through a temporary land association, it would apply the standstill rules for on all of the holding if they're associated with the field parcel. So that might be one issue. The other one in some parts of the UK would be to do with TB restrictions. You know, so but we have in FAS a telephone helpline service, and if you have a specific query, because a lot of these are very specific to an individual situation, you know, give us a ring on that sort of helpline number, and maybe we can help you on a one-to-one basis.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's a really good suggestion. Thanks. Okay, I'm conscious of time. So I'm just going to ask one final question and ask you to wrap up a few top tips before I wrap up on the FAS side of things. So we've talked mostly about livestock movements and ID, because we know that those are the most common things that get picked up in cross-compliance checks. But we also know that there are a few related things which livestock farmers should also have in mind. I'm thinking of potential issues around MVZ designation and watercourse buffer strips in particular. Is there anything that people should be keeping in mind around those kind of things?
Yeah, you're right in saying that livestock, the keeping of livestock triggers sort of obligations in other areas of cross-compliance, especially if it's associated with the application of organic manures. Yep. So, for example, you know, beware that if you're keeping livestock, you need to check if your land lies in a currently designated NVZ. And these areas do change. You know, the field parcels within NVZ areas do change. Sometimes the NVZ area increases if the risk is seen to be increasing, and sometimes field parcels are de-designated as NVZs if they're seen to be of reducing risk. So that does change, and you can sort of get a copy of an up-to-date map on the environment.data.gov.uk site /farmers. Great. Maybe we can sort of make that available.
Yeah.
But if your land lies in an NVZ, then you'll need to do the appropriate calculations for organic manures produced by livestock within that NVZ area. And another key part of cross compliance would be under GAEC 1, where there's a requirement to have a farm map that shows all the buffer zones to watercourses where you're using or applying organic manures. So the requirement to have that farm map with all the buffer zones round about watercourses, springs, wells, boreholes would apply to livestock keepers.
Brilliant. Thank you. Really helpful. I know that there are obviously other things to be aware of, and the cross-compliance guidance is all available online, but it's a fairly hefty tome. So having somebody able to flag up what those key issues are and things to keep in mind is really helpful. I think we are about time, so I will just wrap up. First of all, thank you so much, Ian, for your time today. It's great to have your expertise on the podcast. Thank you also to you as listeners. Please do check out the other episodes in the series, which includes talking to some industry experts on a range of topics supporting farmers through resilience, steps to reduce ammonia emissions on farm, and changes to cross compliance in 2022 more broadly. The podcast and newsletter team would, of course, always welcome any feedback and suggestions on what else you'd like to know about. So please do email us at advice@farmingadviceservice.org.uk. You can find the details online as well, or send us a tweet at DefraFaz. And if you'd like to keep up to date with future podcasts, events, and news from the Farming Advice Service, you can sign up to our monthly newsletter, which is packed full of timely nudges and relevant advice, which is also available on the FAS website, farmingadviceservice.org.uk. And with that, I'll just say thanks again for listening and goodbye.